The first week is the emptying out of ourselves, the hollowing out of a space for God to fill. Let me just add one more note, since most of us are veteran retreatants. I have to shift my analogy here to explain this, but your experience now should not be the same as in past years. If it is, something's wrong. How would I, in order to explain that, I have to use a different metaphor. In the States now, and I think here too, from what some people have been telling me, a lot of young people, when they're about to settle down and buy a home, establish a home, a lot of young people today can't afford the prices of the new houses. So what many of them are doing is buying houses in the inner city, run-down houses or apartments, and then moving in. A lot of the inner city areas are becoming fashionable again because of that, young professionals moving in. And then over the years of their marriage, their early years, maybe 10 years, they remodel the whole thing. Now, I think that's a good metaphor. See, they can't afford $100,000 or $150,000 in one shot. So they buy an old place for $10,000, which they can easily afford. It's a mess now. But then, year by year, as they have the money, they refurbish one or another part of it. Normally, I suppose, you'd begin with the kitchen, because that's probably the most crucial room in the house. And if that's the only room they can afford that first year, they can always put their beds in the kitchen. At least they can survive. Now, I think our process of conversion is like that. It's like maybe a big old house that needs to be renovated, and we can't afford to do it all at once. So maybe one year I do the kitchen, and the next year I move into what we call the sala in the Philippines, the living room. We'd have to decide. I suppose maybe after the kitchen, the master bedroom might be the next one to do. Maybe renovate one of the bathrooms. So I think our lives, our inner selves, are like that house. See, what I'm saying is, if every year you refurbish the kitchen over again, if you go through the same thing again, you're not making any progress. If every retreat is like every other retreat, that's as if you keep fixing up the kitchen every year. Well, you're going to have the best kitchen in the whole of Australia, but the rest of the house is a mess. So what I would suggest is, it's probably good to take a good look at the kitchen, at the parts you've renovated before, and make sure that they're still holding up. And if they need any touching up, fine. But don't get stuck there. There's plenty of other areas of the house that haven't even been explored yet. And we want to move on to those by the grace of God. Find out which areas of this old house, which we've never even been in, are ready perhaps to be transformed this year. So, as I say, make a quick spot check of the areas you've worked on in the past, but don't get stuck there doing it over and over again, because that kitchen will be so beautiful you won't like it, and there'll be nothing else in the house to go with it. Good. Now, in connection with that, too, I think there's a danger there, see, because the devil can work to encourage us to do that. Where we're already strong, he will work to make us stronger. It's a very strange phenomenon. St. Ignatius says that the devil is like a military commander. He reconnoiters us, and he attacks where we're weak. Now, that's connected with what I was saying. I think very often pious people, you can try to look into your own life, but I think oftentimes they confess the things where they are already strongest. People who are so charitable they're going to burst are always confessing every least little violation of charity. They get smaller and smaller. They track down every least little ant or bug in the area of uncharity. And meantime, they're ignoring completely their timidity. And that's the devil working. See, he's willing to be very, very pious for his own ends. If he can keep you perfecting what is already pretty good and keep your eyes off what really needs work, he can have his way in the end. If we use the military metaphor, if the fortress has four walls and three of them are 60 feet high and the other one is knocked down, He'll encourage you to build up the 60-feet ones, to make them 80. As long as the back wall is open, he can get in whenever he wants. And he's willing to make you work harder and harder. Keep your examine on it. Keep agonizing over these least little failings. Kunigunda looks at me cross-eyed and I get hurt. And I confess it for the 5,000th time. Now I only get hurt for 30 seconds. Last year it was 1 minute. Now maybe if I live another 50 years, and Kunigunda lives that long also, I can get it down to 1 second. Well, so what? If you ask the Lord, he might say, well, there's not that much difference between 1 and 30. Why don't you get on to some of these other things where nothing has been done? You know, where you've been brooding over something 50 years. 30 seconds is good enough for Kunigunda. The Lord may say to you, it takes me that long to get over her also. So if you're any more perfect, you'll be better than me. So why not work on something else? But see, the devil will do that. He'll keep us straining and struggling to work where we're already in pretty good shape, as long as he can keep us. If people have a great social conscience, he will torment them to make it better. He'll give them no rest as long as they're not praying. And he's willing to dig and dig and dig at the social concern thing, because that's where they're already strong. And the back wall is wide open and he can go in anytime he wants. So hopefully with the grace of God we can end up smarter than the devil, but it's a hard fight because by nature he's smarter than us. So we do have to work at it. Fine. Now, basically what I'd like to suggest, therefore, is that in this first week, the grace we seek is to see ourselves as God sees us. And this is days 2 and 3 on the sheet. Certainly we can spend this evening and tomorrow on it. And we'll even, as I'll suggest tomorrow night, you can even give it a bit longer if you want. It's true our retreat is brief, but I'll suggest ways that you can maybe extend it in your daily prayer after. So you notice there that, again, I give you several possibilities. If you try all of these, you will surely have a nervous breakdown, because I think out of sheer perversity, I made each of these 5 chapters long, so that you'll be reading the whole day. If we see you at lunch with your book, we'll know that you're trying to do all the readings so that you don't miss any occasion of grace. But, no, these are various possibilities, and I'll give you a little guideline as to how you might choose in case you're not sure. Keep in mind that the focal point is the grace, to know myself, to see myself as God sees me, which is a very rare gift and a very great grace. So the exercises, those numbers of the exercises are the 5 meditations Ignatius gives in the first week. Especially for people who are relative beginners, I think I might take a look at those at least. Although some of the details look a bit ancient to us today, actually the essential dynamics, I think, are still very powerful. So Ignatius has 5 meditations for the first week. The first one is what the famous triple sin one. Some of you, I'm sure, remember that. The sin of the angels, the sin of Adam and Eve, and the sin of a soul in hell for one mortal sin. Even if you don't remember them from here, you've probably heard them from Jesuit directors, and now you can know where they came from. That's the first meditation. The second, third, and fourth focus on my personal sin situation. And then the fifth is a meditation on hell. Now, why that structure? I think if we understand that, it's much more fruitful. Well, the first thing I think to notice is there's one on this triple sin, other people's sin besides my own. Then there's 3 on my own situation, and then there's this sort of appendix on hell. Why? Well, obviously the focus is myself. The key is those 3 central meditations. He prefaces it with this triple sin thing, and he has an epilogue on hell. First of all, why the preface? See, people get hung up today with our superior exegesis and so on. The fall of the angels, The angels aren't as real to most of us today as they were in his day. That's one problem. And it's very hard to meditate on Adam and Eve without getting hung up in all the exegetical problems of whether Genesis 1 and 2 are history or myth. So that meditation can end up in a total confusion if we don't understand the purpose. What he's really doing there, I think, this is the way I understand it now, is what Nathan did with David. If you remember when David was sinning with Bathsheba, and he had Uriah killed, had him, he really worked hard. He tried not to kill him, but when Uriah was too dumb to realize what was going on, he finally had him killed in order to get his wife, Bathsheba. Now David was the king, and Uriah was this loyal soldier who was ready to die for David. And so Nathan, the prophet, comes in, and he tells David that little parable, if you recall, about the man who had thousands of sheep, and a visitor came, a prominent visitor, and he wanted to prepare a feast for him. And instead of taking any of his own sheep, he took the one sheep of a very poor man and sacrificed that in order to feed the guest. And when Nathan told David that story, David became very angry, and he said, "That man must die." And Nathan said, "That man is you." It's a beautiful parable. I think that's what's going on in this first meditation here, as I understand it. See, it's easier to look at sin when I don't have to sign my own name to it. I think what Ignatius is doing in that first meditation is saying, okay, let's look at sin in others and face the reality of it before somebody turns and says, "That man is you." It's easier to face the reality of it sort of outside of ourselves. I think that's really the point of the Adam and Eve and the angels and this theologically dubious thing. What he says is possible. What is dubious today to us is whether it would really happen, the person who's in hell for one mortal sin. It's possible theologically, and God would be within his rights. But knowing the mercy of God and knowing the patience of God, it's hard to imagine. Not that he owes it to us, but that he seems to act in a very different way, as a matter of fact. But as I say, I think all of those are peripheral problems. You can rewrite the parable if you want, but the point is to see the reality of sin, as it were, in itself before I have to acknowledge it as mine. Now, what about the hell meditation at the end? That's a sort of appendix or epilogue, and Ignatius gives us the clue to that. He says, this is not, fear of hell is not a good motive for a just life. He also mentions you can use judgment or death, the four last things, that any of these could be used in addition or by way of substitution. But he says this, the fear of hell or judgment or death, is not the best motive for living a Christian life. Fine, we would all agree. But he's a supreme realist. He says, however, it's a good fire extinguisher. He says, the purpose of that appendix meditation is that lest the love of God ever grow so cold that it cannot keep me from denying him, that at least the fear of hell will block me. And I think even today that's very beautiful. If you remember the Screwtape letters, Lewis, you remember the spiritual direction between Wormwood and Screwtape, where Screwtape is the uncle devil in hell, the senior devil, and Wormwood is his directee. Wormwood is his nephew, and he's an apprentice devil on earth who's trying to learn how to become a good devil. And since Screwtape is his spiritual director back in hell, this is their correspondence. Wormwood's letters have been lost, but all we have are Screwtape's letters. So these are the letters of Screwtape to his nephew, and you can figure out Wormwood's letters from the answers that Screwtape gives. And that's one of the greatest things on discernment that's been written, certainly one of the best in the 20th century, and very funny. But one of the things that Screwtape says to his nephew, the nephew is practicing to be a good devil, and he's very upset because his assigned client or victim no longer believes in devils, and this disturbs him a lot. So he writes back to Screwtape, and Screwtape writes back to him and says, "Boy, you don't know how lucky you are. As long as he doesn't believe in you, you can do anything you want with him. So be sure to encourage that disbelief," which is very, very shrewd. And very, Lewis wrote that 25 years ago, but it's very contemporary today. Sure, as long as we don't believe in the danger, we won't take any care of it. And we're far more vulnerable. And I think that's very much relevant to what Ignatius is saying in that last meditation. So one possibility, as I say, I think especially if we were beginning or relative beginners and our prayer was still more reflective, one possibility would be to take those meditations. If you want to take some scripture, I give you three possibilities there. The last five chapters of Job, the first letter of John, or those five chapters of Romans that I mentioned there. Now, how would you choose? Suppose you wanted to go with the scripture this evening and tomorrow. Let me, if one of them attracts you, why, take that as a sign of what the Lord would like and follow that. But if you're not so sure and you'd like to go with the scripture, this is the way I usually suggest to people to choose. Depending on your present situation before the Lord, if you feel that you're wrestling with God, that you and he are in a kind of tug of war right now, at this point in your life, then I'd take Job. If you feel that things are peaceful but mediocre between you and God, then I would take Romans. If you feel that things are peaceful and pretty deep but need to be deeper, then I would take 1 John. So, as I say, if you're wrestling with God as you judge your situation, then I'd try Job. If things are kind of peaceful, we're not at war, but we're not the best of friends either, then I think I'd use Romans. If we are good friends, but I need to grow in that, then I think I'd use 1 John. So that might give you a little clue. Finally, there is, again, a more autobiographical approach to do this. And if you've never tried this, it's something of my own, but it has worked beautifully the last 2 or 3 years. And many people have told me it was the first time in their life they had ever really seen themselves. I think it's very worth doing once in your life. So that last possibility I mentioned there is to first do a profile of myself as I think God sees me. Remember, the grace we want is to find out how he sees me. Now, you might say, well, why should I say what I think? Because I want to know what he thinks. Well, the reason I have learned in direction, this comes from an experience I've had in direction. Maybe it's different in Australia, but at least I say that to save my life here. In the Philippines, at least, what I find is there's a very big difference between men and women in direction. Men don't come. That's the problem. They don't come for direction. It's very hard for a man to accept dependency. But when they come, they knock you right off the chair. That's my experience. When they finally come, or if they, like the men, the priests on retreat this week, when they came, they'd go right to the point. In my experience, women come easily for direction. But every story begins from Adam and Eve. And, of course, there are exceptions, but that's the general pattern. And when I was young and foolish, that caused me a lot of problems because, being a man, I'd get very restless. You know, if after 45 minutes you just gotten up to Noah, I'd get a little antsy. And usually, I would, being stupid, as I say, I'd try to speed the thing up. So I'd say to the lady, or the sister, or whatever, I think when I thought I could figure out where we were going, you know, I'd say, you know, I think this is the thing you're driving at, to hoping to skip over several centuries. And then invariably the woman would say to me, "No, Father, you don't understand. I'd better start again." Then I realized that I was having the opposite effect of what I wanted. But the beautiful thing was I learned that if I just could play it out and listen, sometimes after that was finished, I could say in two sentences, and I'm not exaggerating, I have, all that I needed to say. And I thought the woman would feel cheated, you know, because if she's talked for an hour and she gets only 30 seconds back, you'd feel she wasn't getting her money's worth. But I found not at all. That was quite a revelation to me. And I began to try to figure out why. Well, see, I think the thing is that she felt that I had really heard her and understood her, and therefore she was able to listen. And if I could put my finger on the thing, it wasn't obviously not always that fast, but there have been times when it was. If I was able to put my finger on the thing, that was all she was seeking. But see, the thing is, I think she couldn't really listen to me until she felt I had heard her. Now, that's what's behind this. If that makes sense to you, it's from that experience in direction, which has been repeated hundreds of times, I think, that I thought of this. See, if we want to hear what God thinks of us, how he sees us, the thing that blocks us is all of our own ideas. And I think it can be very, very fruitful. Even if it takes you the whole morning tomorrow, that's fine. Don't worry at all, it's fine. Just to sit down and say, okay, I'll do a profile of myself as I think he sees me. And I usually tell people, do the things you think he likes first. Let me stress, it's not how you see yourself, but how you think he sees you. Now suppose you say to me, how do I know how God sees me? Well, you know, my answer would be, if you've been living with him 40 years and you don't have any idea, something's wrong. That in itself is a cause for concern. If you have no idea how he sees you, and you've been wedded to him for 40 years, that'd be strange, wouldn't it, if a wife said, how do I know what my husband thinks of me? We've only been married 40 years. That'd be very queer. So I think that in itself would give us cause to pause. I'm not saying it's cause to blame, but we can learn a lot about ourselves from some of the things that come out here very fruitfully. So, not how I see myself, but how I think he sees me. Now, the first point in doing it, I would say do the likes first. I find that very important. What do I think he likes in me? Everything you can think of, big and small. Try to jot down in your journal everything that you can think of that the Lord likes in you. So that when you get finished, you say, well, I don't know. I don't know if it's correct, but there's nothing else I can think of. I drive the car slowly. I stop at red lights. I'm kind to my neighbor. I get up on time for morning visit. I don't know, but whatever I can think of is there. Then take a good break. Now, by the way, if you can't think of what God likes in you, that also is very revealing. In that case, it'd be good if we talk. If you get a much longer list of dislikes than likes, that in itself says quite a bit. That's very helpful once you understand it. See, that probably means that you're much harder on yourself than God is. It probably means that your image of God is not brother or friend, but judge and lawgiver. And it's good to discover that. So, on the other hand, if you can only think of likes and you can't think of any dislikes, be sure to talk to me then, too, because in that case, we have other problems. Either we have other problems or you're ready to be canonized. But it'd be good to check. So, first of all, what he likes. Then take a good break. Then come back and do the same thing with the dislikes. Try to jot down everything that you think he does not like in you, big and small. He doesn't like the fact that I never get jobs done. He doesn't like the fact that I never volunteer for anything. He doesn't like the fact that I'm never on time for morning visit, that I haven't been up before noon in 6 years, whatever it is. Okay, now, the third stage, take a break again, you'll need it after that. And the third stage, this won't be very prayerful, but I promise you it will pay off later if you'd like to try it. The third stage is when you come back, look at the two lists and try to rank the likes and dislikes. And this I find very important. What I mean is, for example, among the things I think he likes in me, which ones do I think he likes most? Which ones, yeah, he likes them, but he's not too excited. Which ones are sort of in the middle? So I have down, I'm always at morning visit on time, and I'm sensitive to the needs of my sisters. Okay, which one do you think he likes better? I hope I know, but it has to be what you think. Which one do I think he values more? So try to rank the likes, and then the dislikes too. See how you think he would, you would rank those as he sees them. Good, then really that may take the morning, if you really do it well, but that's fine. Then begins the praying proper. I admit so far we're more talking to ourselves, but I think it will pay off. First of all, if you can say whenever you finish that, okay, as far as I know, for once in my life, everything's on the table. There's nothing that I can think of, pro or con, which I haven't been able to lay out there, to jot down. That's very liberating. See, because a lot of good people's anxieties are very often vague, unarticulated, and actually unarticulable. We're tormented about vague doubts, which we can't even put a name to. This, I think, is one very good way to exorcise those devils, to be able to say, okay, up until May 7th, 1984, everything I can say about how I think God sees me is down there. Now, you may say, how do I know that's the way he sees me? Well, that's what we want to start listening. Now that we've said everything, we can listen. I think that's where the analogy of my directees comes in. That I think once they have talked and gotten it all out of their system, then they're really able to listen. And I think you may find that with the Lord too. So once you have it all down, bring the list to him and spend the rest of the day listening. Just say, okay, Lord, that's how I think you see me, but I don't know. The grace I ask of you is to, if it's really correct, please confirm it. If you want to correct it, please correct it. And that's the point where, if you want to use that more autobiographical way, at that point the scriptures may come in to help you listen, whichever of the scriptures you chose. What you could do is just read it over. Suppose, for example, you took Romans, just as an example. You could just read through it quietly and maybe mark the passages that strike you especially, the verses, and then maybe spend the afternoon letting them sort of float through your head like a mantra. That's one of the ways the Lord may speak to your profile. But basically, however you do it, I think the real grace we're seeking is that for once in my life I can say, okay, I think I can tell up to this point how he sees me. There's nothing hidden between us. There's nothing I'm refusing to face. Not that he reveals everything at once, no, but there's nothing he wants me to know at this point which I don't know. There may be many things I don't know yet, but there'll be other retreats and other years. That's his business. But there's nothing which I have refused to let him say. In other words, I'm naked before him.